Let's take a few questions.
Okay.
Hi, thank you very much for a great presentation.
Thank you.
I work in the gender group in the World Bank, and I have a couple of questions, one of which is about changing tastes and what other kind of interventions have to go along with switching people's demand from white maize to other sorts of maize. Having spent a lot of time in Zambia, I know how people prize white maize, and having whole grain is a sort of the choice of the poor. And the second one is particularly about the role of women in the family and how you reach, what interventions you do particularly to reach women, both as determining their children's diet and also as producers of crops.
Okay, we'll take one more question back and then we'll go to the web.
Thank you. It's great expose on that part of the puzzle and make a very convincing case on that part of the puzzle and the cost effectiveness of it. Could you discuss that with regard to the other part of the puzzle? And me myself working on livestock, especially now, on how that cost effectiveness compared to other intervention in the ag systems, livestock being able to provide those micronutrients but also to contribute to the overall productivity of the food system. So can you say something about that?
Thank you. So maybe you want to take these three questions and then we go online, take a couple of questions from there and come back to the room.
Okay. I'll go in reverse order. Mm-hmm. If I were Minister of Agriculture of a country, that would be one of the first things I would attack as a long-run strategy. You have to increase the productivity of the non-staple foods. So agricultural research, whatever infrastructure you needed to put in, but subject to budget constraints, that's one of the most fundamental things that needs to be done. Of course, there's a big incentive from the private sector since the prices are going up and up and up, but to me that's fundamental. But it's not going to, what I've discovered about poor farmers is that when they grow something that's high value, they sell it because they just feel they can't, it's too much luxury to eat that high value food. So that's very much long term. Then biofortification is something that used to, 10 years ago it was long term, but now we have the varieties. Country after country that I go to, they ask, why are you only bringing this one crop? We want all your crops. And now we can. We can bring in all the seeds from multi-location testing. All that investment has been done now. And Pakistan wanted the orange maize. They said, that's our fastest growing crop. I said, well, You don't eat that much maize in Pakistan, but they still thought it might be a useful thing to test, etc. Biofortification is now relatively short run, but increasing the productivity of the non-staple foods is an important element that needs to be taken care of. On the taste of the orange maize and the role of the women. First of all, on the role of the women, it's absolutely the women that we're targeting with our messages because they're the ones more than the men that are concerned about the nutrition of their families. And the women, both as farmers and as the person who's preparing the food and is responsible for the recipes. Mm-hmm. Now, with the tape, there are two different cases. You've got iron and zinc, which you can't see and which you can't taste, and you've got vitamin A, which changes the color. Mm-hmm. So I didn't get a chance to talk about Rwanda, but we've introduced high iron beans. We've introduced 10 varieties. We're doing national surveys to confirm that the yields of the biofortified varieties are higher than the normal beans. But I'm told that the average yield of the biofortified beans is a ton and a half, and the average yield is a ton of the regular beans. That's gonna drive the spread and the adoption of the high iron beans. We've already been able to make the high iron beans available to 30% of bean farmers in Rwanda. And I think it's just gonna take off by itself because of the high yields. And that's, to me, that's like putting fluoride in the water system. At some point, most of the beans in the system are high iron beans, and you don't have to convince the mothers or anybody. They're just that's what the supply is. Okay? You can't follow that strategy with the orange maize. So you have to provide the knowledge of why you would switch to an orange variety. You have to motivate that, and you have to spend money to do that. We're lucky that they like the taste of the orange maize. So we do the blindfold tests, and everybody says, yeah, this is the white maize, this is the orange maize. But we got lucky, they liked the taste of the orange maize. So this is anecdotal, but our country manager serves orange maize at home. His uncle came and he sat down and he said, I'm not eating that stuff. And they said, well, this is what we have. If you could just eat this tonight, we'll switch back to white maize for tomorrow's meals. And came the next day and they had white maize and he said, I didn't tell you to switch. So it's, they like the taste and they understand it costs the same amount of money. It's orange, yeah, but it protects my family from vitamin A deficiency. So it's starting to catch on. It's being sold in supermarkets. That's not our target audience, but you need it to be marketed. You need a demand for it because the farmers want to be able to sell part of what they grow. So I'm optimistic about what's going on in Zambia. Then the last one is about the hybrids. Okay. With the hybrid varieties, you have to pay more for the seed, but you get higher yields. And so already most of maize production in Zambia and indeed in Africa, not all countries, but hybrids are starting to take over the production. Same with pearl millet. We do have open pollinated varieties available. We have been breeding open pollinated varieties for the more vulnerable populations. But it's going to be much more expensive to distribute those through the NGOs, whereas with the private seed companies, it's becoming part of their business, and you can just kind of leave it by itself, and you don't have the cost. Now our other crops are not hybrids, so you've got rice, you've got wheat, the vegetatively propagated crops like cassava and sweet potato. They're much more expensive to distribute and get out to farmers.
Okay, thank you. Should we just take a question from online?
Sure, yeah. So there have been a few questions that have come up around the issue of soils. And so particularly Anita Blake and Sarah Mine asked, how does the change in soil affect the nutrient requirements for biofortified plants? And then, is there any research, if you can speak to the ability of farm management practices to improve soil and plant health and human nutrition? What's the soil-crop connection? Would this be considered biofortification? And is it an area for more research?
Okay.
Thank you.
I have a couple of questions. The first one relates to the interactions with other minerals. For example, maize is phytates, and we know that if a phytate impairs iron absorption, it also impacts on zinc absorption, calcium, and other bivalent minerals. So I'm wondering if you increase the concentration of iron in one of your products, and it does in the end affect the bioavailability and the absorption of other similar nutrients like iron, zinc, and calcium, or calcium agent. So if you're talking about effectiveness, do you factor that into account that maybe if you increase iron content, you're actually reducing zinc absorption and therefore compromising the zinc nutritional status? The other one relates to the yellow maize. I remember in Zimbabwe we had a massive drought and we ended up importing yellow maize. Even up to now, I can't eat yellow maize. It just did not taste the same. We actually disliked it. But we had no choice. We ate it. But as soon as we got to produce our own white maize, we went back to the white maize. In fact, even in rural areas, my father has a mill. the whiter the male is, actually, the better. We know that if you, the less white, it's still got some of the nutrients. But people in the rural areas actually prefer the whiter maize, because the whiter maize is more refined and status to it. Mm-hmm. So even if you go there and tell them that, oh, you know, the less white maize is more nutritious, it's good for your health, but the social status and the taste trumps the nutritional status. So I'm curious about, in the end, the overall acceptability of the yellow maize. And in humanitarian situations where people have no options, I think it makes sense. But when you now expand to the general population,
yeah.
I personally...
Yeah.
Okay, Martin?
Yeah. Thanks for the presentation. So as far as I understand, so for to improve cost effectiveness, you need scale. And the question then is, you know, how can we accelerate adoption by farmers of those new varieties? And I'm more wondering whether there's an opportunity in India, I mean, to accelerate it. I mean, the issue is that because of the extensive input subsidy regime that is in place in India, this is heavily kind of favoring, I mean, production of the food grains and actually hampering the diversification into high-value agricultural fruit and vegetables. I mean, that's a very negative kind of effect of the subsidy regime that's in place. Now, of course, at the World Bank, we've had many of years of, you know, engagement with the government of India to actually change that subsidy regime or get rid of it, but for political economy reasons, I mean, that's a very difficult kind of proposition. But the question then is, you know, if you recognize that negative effect for the purpose of, you know, focusing on nutrition, the question is, can you actually change the rules of the game of that current subsidy regime to actually provide incentives for adoption of biofortified, you know, millet or wheat or rice, by actually putting a suggestion on the table that actually the procurement system in India and the corresponding public distribution system actually over time, I mean, let's say over 5 years or over 10 years, actually moved entirely to biofortified grains. Actually, the public procurement system only buys biofortified grains. And the public distribution system and distribution from is that a conversation that Harvest is having with the government of India? Would that be, if that would be accepted, that would make a huge
difference? So, over to you, Harvey. Yeah. Maybe you want to repeat Martin's question, since people online may not have heard the question.
Yeah. So, yeah, again, I'll go in reverse order. So, the last question was about using the food subsidy system in India, we have to take as a given that it's inefficient to have these food subsidies, but given that it is inefficient, can we use the system to drive adoption of biofortified crops? And the answer is yes, absolutely. And that's going to be the main way, if we're successful, that'll be the main way that biofortified wheat and biofortified rice will be adopted. It's very difficult for us to... We can equal the yields of the best varieties, but it's very difficult for us to beat the yields of the best varieties in the circumstance of India. So if the government officials would give preference to the purchase of biofortified varieties, they'd still be basically the same price, because they're just as productive and you get the added value of the zinc in the wheat and in the rice. It makes sense. And the government officials, and we've talked to government officials about this, and they say, yes, let's try it. I need, you know, 200 million tons, you know, next week, and let's do it. And so that's, you know, that's the problem right now, is we've just released the varieties. We don't have enough seed. We're trying to multiply the seed and get to the point where there's enough, you know, to where we can seriously start, getting into one of the state programs, or, you know, getting our foot in the door. So that's going to, if we're successful in India, that's absolutely going to drive the success. Now, at the same time, the food subsidy system has been given preference to wheat and rice and excluded millets. And millets are actually much more nutritious. And then we've got a high iron millet. So I was, we met with, in August, we met with the state government in Rajasthan, and they've agreed to do a pilot where they take the wheat, they substitute high iron permalate for wheat in some of the districts in Rajasthan, and we're going to do a comparative analysis, an intervention and a control, and see if we can record an improvement in iron status through that. So yeah, you absolutely hit the nail on the head there with India. Again, you asked about, you know, the orange is not popular, but you know that's just what, you know, this is what's not popular is this yellow maize. We do have a separate, it is distinguishable in terms of its color, but the important thing is that people like the taste. When they try it, they seem to like the taste. They don't like the taste of this because it's not really, a lot of the stuff that was sent as food aid wasn't bred for human consumption. So that's exactly what the drama is. We have to reach a certain threshold of people that try it and like it and eat it, and then if it really is a good product, it'll spread because the value proposition is too good. You get vitamin A. It tastes good, and it's the same price. So, you know, all I can say is, you know, come back in 5 years and we'll see what happened in Zambia. Incidentally, FAO just gave us a big grant to now introduce orange maize into Zimbabwe. So it's right next door, and we'll see what happens. On the phytates, yeah, we had huge debates on phytates in the 1990s when we were trying to convince people to invest in biofortification. Some people said the absorption would be way too low because of the phytates. Other nutritionists said it depends on your iron status. If you have low iron status, you'll absorb a high percentage. If you have high iron status, you'll absorb a low percentage. There were debates about whether the meal methodology, test meals over a few days, whether that really accurately measured the bioavailability, if people had a chance to adjust over a longer period of time. And I can say that now the studies are in, and it shows that the latter group was correct, that people with low iron status absorb at a much higher rate than the people with high iron status. We measured absorption rates as high as 15% when we did a high iron rice study in the Philippines and around. It was done in 2001, 2002. So
I was thinking about the zinc iron interactions, not that if you increase absorption of iron, don't you compromise absorption of zinc or calcium or others? Because
we're adding at levels that are normally in diets. We're not adding, you know, we're not fortifying with iron and zinc at the same time at high levels. So all of our efficacy trials are, you know, we're basically having very positive results on our efficacy trials. I'm not a nutritionist, but this is what I know about the results of the efficacy trials. So there were several questions about soils and farm management practices. We've tried putting another way of adding zinc to the seeds is putting zinc and fertilizers. So you can put zinc and fertilizers, it gets in the soil, and it makes its way into the seeds. We've done several experiments with that. It does increase seed zinc content, but not by enough to make that much of a difference. But we have found that when you spray zinc during a particular period of plant growth, you can, if you add it to insecticides or whatever you're spraying for, you can massively increase the seed zinc content through spraying. The problem is we haven't found the motivation for farmers to do that, the economic motivation for farmers to do that. They have to spray during a specific period of plant growth. Why would they do this? To feed their families with higher zinc? No, they're not. That's not going to motivate them to spray. So we haven't found the economic motivation. Maybe in India, if you could bring in your wheat and your rice that has higher zinc content, then that would give a motivation to the farmers if you, you have that as part of your food subsidy program. It's often asked whether we're going to deplete the soils of zinc and iron. You can deplete soils of nitrogen and phosphorus with just a few crops, but with, it's a completely different situation with trace minerals. There are enough trace minerals in the soils for thousands and thousands of crops. The amounts, they're actually minute, they're trace amounts that you're adding. You need them for your health, but they're physically just trace amounts and you're not significantly depleting the soils. So maybe I'll stop with that.
Okay, all right. Rose, if you can check if there is a question online, and while you get that together, let me mention two things. One on the PDS issue. I think what Martin said about biofortification and what you answered, similar conversations are happening around commercial fortification as well. Can we do commercially fortified wheat flour, for example, and use that through the PDS system? And second, on soils and micronutrients, there is research ongoing on zinc fertilizers for soil that would get into the soil, but then into the crops and into food systems as well. So there are a bunch of other things that are ongoing as well. And now there are a couple of burning questions, so I would request that you be really, really brief. Let's start with the online question, then yourself, and then yourself, and then you finish.
Yeah. So just two brief online questions. One is there any risk of losing nutrients during processing of any of these crops? And also, how can the private sector and the food industry become involved and better contribute to this?
Yes, I'm interested in opening up the Codex discussion. With the Codex discussion, it seems like one risk you run with that is this question of whether or not genetic engineering can be used in biofortification, just because of the controversy around that in Codex. I have the stars to show you. So I'm interested in that, and I'm interested in what you hope to get out of that beyond the definition. Is it meaning that you have to achieve a certain level of biofortification? Is that what you're hoping to get? But how else are you going to deal with this controversy around genetic engineering?
All right, thank you. Next, last question.
I hate to, ask one. At the moment, it's become very expensive for small-scale farmers to produce maize, particularly because of its high requirement for nutrients, NPK in particular. And many of them are actually struggling to put food on the table. I wonder how far you have gone in terms of making this particular variety a bit less in terms of requiring NPK. Otherwise, I see a situation where it's a very good intervention but may become a source of expensive vitamin A in the end, and we fail to get to the goal that we are aiming for.
All right, thank you. So over to you, Javi, and then I'll hand it over to Stephen so that he can summarize all the wonderful things that have been said tonight.
Okay. So again, I go last back. We're trying to be the least invasive possible. So if farmers are growing a particular crop and they're using fertilizer, we just give them a variety that you just replace one for the other and you continue using fertilizer. If you don't use fertilizer, again, you just substitute one for one. We're not asking them to use more fertilizer, less fertilizer, do more plowing, less plowing. You just keep your practices the same. You just substitute the biofortified variety. Now, farmers are facing many problems, and that's the job of the agricultural research community, to give them better and better technologies to help them meet their problems. So, for example, our centers are breeding for climate change. They're breeding drought-tolerant varieties, submergence-tolerant varieties. The beans are heat-tolerant so that they can adapt to climate change. What we're doing is we're piggybacking on the best varieties that are coming out. because farmers eventually will be adopting these climate-adapted crops, and we need to make them biofortified. Otherwise, people will forget about our biofortified varieties, and they're gonna adopt the climate-adapted crops. So that's kind of our approach. On the Codex, I think that one of the main things is to come up with standards. As biofortified crops become popular, we're afraid that people will start selling things that are not, they'll label them as biofortified, but they won't be biofortified. So we need some kind of standards to avoid that, and also with the international trade.
Do you mean a minimum level of nutrients?
Yeah.
That has to be?
Yeah. And it's up to the, in the end, it's up to, obviously up to the Codex process. Harvest Plus isn't going to say this is what we want the standard to be. It's going to be the negotiation process that goes on. You understand it much better than I do. Now with that, you're right. The genetic engineering is a huge problem. The developing countries tend to love the idea of biofortification. Europe is a little bit wary because they're afraid we're pro-GMO. The U.S. is a little bit worried because they think we're anti-GMO. So we're having our biggest problem with the United States and Europe, but the developing countries, they're pretty much 100% for us. So what we're trying to do is say the mode of production is not part of the definition. That's how we're trying to get around that problem. So we have, Ann McKenzie, she's very skilled and knows the Codex.
Yes, she has the stars to show.
So that's how we're trying to get around that. On the question on the retention, absolutely a lot of the nutrients are lost in the storage and the processing. So for example, in the vitamin A maize, when it's freshly harvested, let's say it has 15 parts per million provitamin A maize, and some of it's eaten right away. But when it's stored, it loses over time, over several months, it loses the levels of vitamin A. When it's processed into flour, it loses some of its vitamin A. So when we set the target levels, we take for the breeders, we take the losses in processing into account. We assume that 40%, on average, 60% of the vitamin A is lost on average before it's consumed. But the 40% that's left provides half of your vitamin A requirement. So yes, we absolutely take account of the losses in processing. We want the food industry to be involved in buying the biofortified crops and putting them in their products, mainly because that creates the markets for the farmers. We don't think a lot of the processed foods don't have that much of the nutrient left in them when they're sold in the supermarket shelves, but because the food processing companies are buying them, that helps generate the market. And absolutely, the farmers want to be able to sell part of what they produce. Otherwise, they're not going to just adopt the biofortified crops for their own families.
Okay, thank you. No more online. Over to you, Stephen.
Yeah, I think what I'm hearing is the need to get both the science and the art right. And you described that as the drama. Right?
Good.
And so the science has now delivered a lot of results.
Yeah.
And the drama is now maybe the most challenging thing with perceptions, production, distribution systems, seed, particularly for potatoes, things like that.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I'm thinking maybe the World Bank's role is more about leveraging the science and so dealing with the drama.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's one thing we can finance and NARS and whatever, that's going to take some years and whatever, but
right.
We are trying to interact with subsidy systems, with IFCs working with food companies. So I think that's maybe an area where we need to be looking at is beyond the science. I think the point you made about in circumstances where you're getting a higher yield or greater disease resistance, then the science trumps the art, right? Yeah. So it solves the problem.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
And to the extent to which the next generation of breakthroughs are of that nature, then the sort of burden of adoption will be lower.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to end with a question, but I'll catch you afterwards. I have a question on the thinking about the cost side. But I just want to thank everybody and the folks who are connected and their questions, and thank Howard for a very interesting, thought-provoking presentation, and we're very happy to be here.
Okay, thank you.